Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Greg Bresnitz.
And I'm Darren Bresnitz. We're the host of Snacky Tunes.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Own the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. We're coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, September 16th. This is the 78th episode of the series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guests are an award-winning journalist power couple, and I will introduce them in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start out with my PR tip. Then later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. Today's tip is to not be afraid to mix work and pleasure. It's okay to combine your business life with your social life. I always tell people that I have one social work life, so I can't separate the two. This works for me, and it could work for you. Of course, you need to find the right balance, but it can be a winning combination. So be open-minded to mixing things up. That's my tip today. Now, I'm very honored and excited to have my guests here. They are Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, two-time James Beard award-winning creators of The Flavor Bible, The Vegetarian Flavor Bible, What to Drink with What to Eat, Culinary Artistry, Becoming a Chef, and more, plus the forthcoming Kitchen Creativity. And I could go on and on, so I'm going to break in and talk to you guys because I'm just honored to have you here. So welcome.
Oh, we're happy to be here. Great to see you, Sherry.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, your accolades and your I could do the whole show just reading about everything you accomplished, but let's let's dive into it. And no, it's very impressive. And I'm going to start out with my question from last week, because I asked my guest, Jeannie Voltsinis, the chef concierge at the Viceroy New York Hotel, to ask you a question. And her question was, how did you start your careers? I know.
Just
I
have a real easy one.
Yeah.
It's not even open-ended at all, yeah.
Well, kicking it off with that.
Well, let's see. I guess our career together as authors kicked off in 1992 when we landed our first book deal to write our first book, which was Becoming a Chef, which came out in 1995. And prior to that point, Andrew had been working as a professional chef, cooking in top restaurants in Boston and New York City. He'd worked with James Beard Award winner Chris Schlesinger at the East Coast Grill and Lydia Shire at Biba in Boston. Nice. And then when we moved to New York in 92, he was working with Ann Rosenzweig. And he had never gone to cooking school and was really interested in, you know, should he, you know, he'd worked with these great chefs and was learning so much in their kitchens, but he, as he hadn't been to cooking school, should he leave and go to cooking school? Could he work his way up? And I said, you should really go buy a book on becoming a chef. He said, there are no books on becoming a chef. And I said, well, maybe you should write one. And we did some research. We found out that the chef's profession was named one of the top 10 careers for the 1990s. And I thought, you know, there's a real opportunity here. You should seriously consider writing a book. And he said, well, I'm not really, I don't think of myself as a writer. And I said, well, I'll help you. And so those were the magic words that led us to write our first book proposal, which got turned down by every literary agent and every editor that eventually saw it except one. And so thank you to Pam Churls of Van Oosten Reinhold, who said yes, because you only need one yes. And that led to the first book, which everybody said, you know, isn't going to be a bestseller. It's not going to get on the Today Show. Just be really happy that you published your first book. It's a big accomplishment. And we thought, well, we didn't work for 2.5 years of weekends and evenings to let it sit on the shelves. So we promoted our way to having it be on the Today Show, having it win the James Beard Award for Best Writing on Food, and that kind of launched the rest. So one book led to the next, which led to the next, and we lose track. We're either on book number 10 or 11 or something like that.
Wow. So the first book won James Beard, and now it's coming up. It's its 20th anniversary.
Exactly.
Yes. It's incredible. So did you... I mean, you said you wanted to you'd help him. Were you writing at the time? I mean, what's your background?
I had actually gone to journalism school at Northwestern. So I started out at Medill. I was a Scripps Howard Foundation journalism scholar there. And I'd always been interested in writing and hopeful that I would figure out something to write about, that I could actually write books, never dreaming it would be food. But after getting my undergraduate degree in economics and going on to business school and consulting with Fortune 500 food and beverage companies, and really being interested in some of the strategic issues that food companies were facing, and really understanding how when Andrew would come home at night, we would talk about some of the flavor concepts and product development concepts that my clients were grappling with. And I was getting a lot of insight from him and from his colleagues and from his industry, and realizing that the best chefs in America were really sort of the early warning system, the research and development arm, if you will, for really what was going on in food in America. So we had a lot of really interesting conversations about that. And I realized that the two were much more closely linked. I think even back then, in sort of the late 1980s, early 1990s, you could see that some of the flavor trends, some of the product trends, they were all starting with the top chefs in America and kind of trickling through the food chain, so that you're seeing things in the frozen food aisle and in the grocery store aisle, that I think some of those concepts really started with some of the top chefs in the country.
Yeah, I agree. Andrew, how did you two meet?
Let's see. I just moved to Boston from San Francisco, and I was visiting New York for the very first time. It was Thanksgiving weekend. I was with a roommate, and we had a mutual friend. This was back in the day where you could commute between Boston and New York like for $15 or $25 on People's Express. And we had a mutual friend that Karen did not know that we had a mutual friend. And our mutual friend said, oh, you can stay in my apartment in Brooklyn. Call Karen Page. She's the funnest girl in New York City. You know, if you two guys visit, if you're visiting New York for the very first time, you're going to call the funnest girl in New York City.
Of course you are.
Yeah, and you're going to call her 12 times until you finally get a hold of her at work on a Saturday night on Thanksgiving weekend. Luckily, she took pity on these two. First off, she's like, who are you? What's going on here? I said, we're at the Pyramid Club. Our friend is so-and-so. She said to give you a call, and Karen said, oh, sure, I'll meet for a drink. She was smart. I'll meet for a drink. And then next thing you know, we're eating, actually going out for Italian in Brooklyn. And then back in those days, we could then, you know, go home, rest up, and then go out dancing. And we've been together ever since that first flash
night
of the eyes.
30 years ago, this Thanksgiving.
So 30 years later. And
that's awesome. Yeah. I see the love. The love in the room. It's everywhere. Yeah.
That's the PG version.
Okay. Good. Got it. Got it. This is Heritage Radio, though. We'll move on. So what's it like on this first book, like actually writing this book together? How was the division of work? You know, how did it work?
Well, Karen's always been the lead writer of all of our books. And she will have a vision and can think linearly, which is not naturally my forte, unfortunately. But what's fun was when we started doing the interviews early on, we sort of saw how each other played differently, in that if I was talking to a chef, we could get into very easily chef speak. And it would be very insider and like, ha, 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 yak, yak, yak. Oh, and then this guy threw a rondo through a window. And like, you know, Chef and I would be laughing, and Karen would be like,
what the heck's a rondo?
What's a rondo?
Yeah.
And so first off, she sort of made it so the dialogue would approach everybody and help everyone and be clear. But she also wasn't an insider. She wasn't someone who worked the line like I did. And so she could ask much bigger questions, much bigger context questions that I was still sort of a forest for the trees sort of guy at that point in time. I was still working the line for our first few books. And so my perspective really was, you know, a 12-foot-long kitchen surrounded by metal with a lot of screaming and yelling and, you know, that sort of thing going on. And obviously the industry's changed dramatically, and we've been able to chronicle that. But Karen always brought, which was so important, a very different outside view. And also just as an observer of seeing what's going on in the culinary world, that's sort of what had been our sort of one of the strengths and weaknesses of our writing.
Well, I think I had studied sociology. That was a particular passion of mine at Northwestern as an undergrad. And so I just realized that sort of from a sociological perspective, what I experienced my husband going through on a day-to-day basis in the kitchen was unlike any other work environment I'd ever studied or heard of. You know, he would come home and say, oh, yeah, I got screamed at today. I said, well, you're being euphemistic. You know, I mean, someone literally screamed at you. That would be barbaric. He's like, no, I basically got screamed at. And, you know, you hear about, as we started our interviewing for Becoming a Chef, you learned about the history of some of the French chefs who were involved in the early, you know, apprenticeships in France, where, you know, they started at the age of 13. They were treated basically like slaves. It's in their own words, they would use that word. And, you know, they said, basically, the chef owned me. And they would, you know, swat you around if they didn't like what you were doing or to punish you. So there was a very interesting tradition that way of that sort of, you know, kind of evolved over time into the culture of kind of the screaming, yelling restaurants, which some people today wouldn't. If you're just entering a restaurant kitchen today, you might not be aware that that was part of the tradition, you know, but because I think now you've got a lot more open kitchens. It used to be behind the little closed door, so the behavior was a little different than it is today with the open kitchens. There's, you know, a culture of serenity. We're hopefully more evolved as an industry, so you're seeing chefs really, you know, setting a whole different example than they did when we were a little more rough and tumble in the kitchen.
I think the sort of the serenity is a good thing on a lot of levels. One, it's much easier to concentrate when it's quiet and no one's like yelling at you. But also, if you think about the dining experience, like where Charlie Trotter put in a kitchen table, you know, years ago, or if you're dining at 11 Madison, you might get a kitchen tour and you go back and you see 30 people working pretty much silently, completely focused. I mean, it isn't the Wild West anymore. It's a very serious, very sophisticated career that's going on where people have trained very hard, worked very hard to get to where they are. And like, again, thinking of someone like 11 Madison, where that is the dining, you know, the kitchen is part of the dining experience. And so you really can't go back there and see chaos because, A, it wouldn't produce the food that you're trying to produce at 11 Madison.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this, but I lived in Chicago for a few years before New York, and I was a server at Trotter's, and sometimes I was assigned to that kitchen table, and it was the chef's table right there at the pass, and it was stressful because you were presenting in front of these people, and the kitchen was there, and it was all the show was open. But it was also, I learned so much from being there, and it was like a thrilling experience at the same time. Like it was really great. But you're right, it's different now because now there's so many.
Right, that was pioneering in those
exactly.
days.
Charlie was pioneering, certainly,
in so
many
ways. Mm-hmm. Right. But so it's really evolved. I think, you know, we've seen the evolution of the professional restaurant kitchen from the blue collar profession, and, you know, a different type of person maybe dominating that kitchen to evolving into certainly craftsmanship, and I think in some restaurant kitchens really approaching the level of artistry. And so there's a different sociological perspective that really applies to each of those kitchens at different points in time, which is fascinating.
Yeah, and I brought a surprise.
We love surprises.
Good. So back from 1998... I have Dining Out.
Book number 3.
I bought this back when I was in Chicago. You know, this is a time, now I buy tons of books, all the, you know, supporting lots of chefs and people I know. But somehow I was influenced to buy this incredible book that you guys wrote. And I've had it. And yeah, so I've known you. I mean, this is back in my serving days. I've known you since then. And so it's truly.
1998.
Yeah.
So, came out.
So tell me about the inspiration.
And you know who's on the cover. That's Ruth Reichel, who's actually on the cover of the New York Times food section today. So we've come full circle.
You have. It reminded me a little of Gail Green. The way with the hat,
right.
You know, but so tell me about this book a little bit. What inspired it?
Well, after we finished Becoming a Chef and Culinary Artist, you know, one book always leads to the next. And so Becoming a Chef, Andrew was still at, in that perspective of, you know, I think I want to be a chef restaurateur. What are all the secrets I can learn so I can do that? And then we fell in love with the process of researching chefs and restaurateurs and really wanting to get inside their heads and to share that. But we realized after we wrote Becoming a Chef, we hadn't written much about food. And so that's what led to Culinary Artistry, where we really wanted to take the same approach that we did with Becoming a Chef and looking at their career paths to looking at their artistry and the way that they approached culinary composition. And so that was a book that really approached from the chef's perspective what they do, how they do what they do, and how they approach creativity. With Dining Out, we wanted to flip it on its side in sort of a Rashomon-like perspective of, okay, now let's take a look at, you know, chef's creative process from the perspective of critics. You know, when they taste this, how do they decide if it's brilliant or if it's BS or something in between? And how do they make these pronouncements that this is worthy of 4 stars or 1 star or no stars? And so we spent a year eating out with restaurant critics all across America. And we did eat out with Ruth, who's actually on the cover of the book. We ate out with Gail Green when she was still writing for New York Magazine, and across the country with their colleagues, Dennis Ray Wheaton, Chicago Magazine, and your neck of the woods in Chicago when you were there. We ate out with Sherry Verbila from the LA Times, Jonathan Gold, who at that point was LA Weekly.
Tough job, yes. The research you had to do.
So it was fun because a lot of times at that point in time, these critics were maintaining their anonymity. And so we sort of felt like, you know, just finding out what they looked like, what they were really like, was pretty, I think, exciting for me as a, you know, food enthusiast and a little traumatic for Andrew as a professional chef.
It was definitely traumatic at times. I think the first time we were going to interview our very first critic was Robert Sietsma. He was with The Voice at the time. We're walking down the street, and I was pretty uptight, to say the least. And Karen's like, what's the matter? I'm like, who is this guy to judge my bouillabaisse? Who is this guy? And she's like, honey, you're a journalist right now. You're not a chef. Change the hat. And it turned out to be a fascinating conversation, and I found Robert to be incredibly wonderful, interesting, and insightful. And I found that with all the critics, but actually how compassionate they were. I mean, again, if you're reading it like the sports page, you just sort of see like, oh, who are they going to take down this week, or what's, you know, tough. And then you realize, and I realized at the time, is how desperate they all were to find the next great restaurant or just any restaurant. And we're eating out, I think is what Karen was referencing, we're eating out with Gail Green at lunch, and we're eating, and the first thing the chef did wrong was send out an extra course. So we'd had enough interviews to know, when the critic comes in, you don't acknowledge him. You don't send out extra courses. He sends out an extra course. Then he comes over and says hello. Ooh, strike number two. And then we get done, and Gail just quite frankly says, you know, I'm not going to write this place up. Go ahead and have dessert. It's not special enough. And I just felt like this poor kid. I mean, my heart just fell out of my chest for him. And then I thought about it. Well, she has 52, you know, reviews, possibly maybe less a year. And is this one worthy of, you know, being in that New York Magazine slot? And like, looking back, it's like maybe not, but at the moment, I wasn't a critic. I was just the compassionate, sympathetic cook to this
right.
guy who
to
came
see
out of
this guy's
table.
Career is heading
it's like, yeah, it's
south.
Like, and just knowing that he's going to be opening up New York Magazine for the next month and a half, going, "Am I in? Am I in? Am I in?" And so
yeah.
It was an interesting process. It was also interesting when the meals we had with Ruth Reichel was we're out, and she said, "You know, we were out at a steak restaurant," and she goes, "You know, I'm ordering liver today." Like, I'm not eating prime rib every single time.
I think it was her third visit.
Her third
visit.
So
she'd already eaten, you know, the prime rib and the T-bone and the other.
And then she also sort of alluded to, yes, I've been spotted because, you know, there's a waiter, you know, 10 feet away sort of watching the table. And she knew that. And she was not facing the waiter. She was facing us. And so she picked up on all the subtleties. And I think the other thing that was fascinating was I was at a restaurant and the maitre d' was hired to spot the critic. I mean, they had a lot more clout in these days when that book came out.
I think they still
do. Oh, they still do. I mean, I think yeah. Everyone still wants a great review in the New York Times. But it was very funny. We were cooking in at the time, and the chef goes, "Ruth Reichel is in the house." So it's like everyone's on alert. So, you know, it was a very different time, but still, I still pick up the New York Times every Wednesday, and I still read Gail Green on Monday when she posts. I still read all the reviews. They're still fun.
Yeah, incredible. Okay, so we're going to take a little break here, come back, talk some more with Karen and Andrew. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
And this lovely song is by the California Honey Drops. It's called Spreadin' Honey. We are coming right back.
Okay, welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guests today are award-winning co-authors Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg. So, we have so much to talk about. So the flavor Bible. Let's get into that, because that was influenced by culinary artistry, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we had started our exploration of culinary creativity with culinary artistry. I think that's where our thinking and our focus really started getting playful with the concept of how chefs were approaching creativity. And we realized one of the most popular aspects of that book were the brief sets of lists of what flavors go together in that book. And so we realized 10 years later, there was really the need for a book that really brought it up to date, that got a lot more specific about flavor pairings and really took things to the next level. And so the Flavor Bible has been described as culinary artistry on steroids, which I kind of like, because it really goes into the next level. What really, you know, dissecting flavor, a lot of people will use the words flavor and taste interchangeably when, in fact, one is a subcomponent of the other. And so taste is really a part of flavor, which reflects what's going on in the tongue, the four basic tastes of sweet, sour, salty, bitter, plus the fifth taste, umami, plus the next tastes that the researchers identify and that we can agree are part of the palate. But it's so much more than that. It's mouthfeel, it's texture, it's temperature, it's aroma. Aroma is a huge part of flavor. As we learned, as we both went through sommelier training programs to earn our sommelier certificates, but it's also something we call the mysterious X factor, which is every other factor we haven't identified yet that plays a role in flavor. And we're talking about things like the fact that your mother used to make a particular dish when you were growing up, or your grandmother, and that you've got, you know, it sort of tugs on your heartstrings every time you taste that. That's a legitimate part of the flavor experience.
Nostalgia.
And so, sorry?
Nostalgia.
Yeah. Nostalgia, memory.
Yeah. No, that's cool.
All of it.
Yeah.
So it all kind of comes together, and we use the Flavor Bible as an opportunity to really explore different aspects of flavor in ways that it had not been explored before. And what we were so thrilled to find is that it was so broadly useful, these concepts of flavor, not only to professional chefs who use it to come up with their next special when they're designing new menus, but also home cooks. They get their CSA boxes. They don't know what to do with a rutabaga. They don't know what to do with any mm-hmm. particular ingredient. They can look it up and find a list of the herbs, spices, and other seasonings that best enhance their flavor. But it's also useful to bar chefs and mixologists. And so there's a whole cult following. If you go to the modern, actually, Levy Carter, the wine writer and sommelier, had tipped us off to that in a tweet on Twitter. And he said, I was just in the modern, and they've got a whole, this beautiful shelf of cocktail books with these custom-designed slip covers at the modern. And the together, the spines of the book that face the bar, the spines of the books create a cocktail glass, a martini. And one of the center books is actually the Flavor Bible. And so they have it front and center with their most prized cocktail books. And so we're thrilled that it's behind the bar at some of the best restaurants all across the country, being used not just in their kitchens, but behind the bars to make new cocktails. And it's also used by brewmasters to make new beers. It's used by nutritionists to design new recipes that get around whatever particular dietary restriction people tend to have, whether it's gluten-free or sugar-free or meat-free.
Everything's free now. Free of everything.
So we're really thrilled with how broadly applicable it's turned out to be.
Well, I also found the book just very inspirational, just as I still pick it up. And if someone's not familiar with it, basically we interviewed chefs all around the country and talking about these topics. And actually one that really jumped out for me was we were interviewing Daniel Hume of 11 Madison. And he goes, "Oh, I love asparagus soup." And we're like, "Well, talk about asparagus soup." And for 15 minutes, he broke down exactly how he made asparagus soup. And you could read that sidebar and not have to have a recipe to make asparagus soup. It's like, oh, I take my asparagus, I blanch it, I save all the blanching water, and I use that as a base for the soup, then I put into the bottoms, I your puree, da-da-da-da. And I think that's the other thing. There's a lot of people who don't need recipes anymore. No, a lot of people don't need to be told, put on pan on medium, film with a little bit of olive oil, yada, yada, yada. It's like, I have some asparagus. I know how to blanch asparagus. I know how to saute asparagus. And I had to throw it into a stir fry. But what else should I throw into my stir fry with my asparagus? And I think that's where the book is really helpful. It's just like, you don't have to comb through 300 pages of a recipe-laden book. And also, I think the important thing is ingredients change throughout the season. So it does help you, like, okay, if you're going to put something with basil, it's like, well, taste your basil, because in this the beginning of the season it's very light. Right now it's pretty darn bitter. It's September, so it's like it's a very different basil, so you can't just say teaspoon of basil, half a tablespoon of basil, da 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 da. It's like, so I think the goal was to really free up people, and that's what really has it, is to sort of free up people who know how to make a pasta. And it's like, well, what am I gonna put in my pasta? It's like it's, you know, I can't look at one more tomato. It's like, well, here's a bunch of ideas for tomatoes. Maybe you want to saute them, roast them. Here's some ideas for strawberries. You know, throw them in the oven for 15 minutes. This is from Emily Lucchetti, one of the great pastry chefs in America. So the other thing that's fun is, you know, when we talk about, like, you know, tough life, we could hang out with the very best chefs around the world and the country and say, gosh, tell us your secrets so we can share them with everyone else. And that's really what happens in the Flavor Bible.
It's terrific because, no, the you're right. There are a lot of cooks that do want the step-by-step.
Sure.
But there are a lot, and I think it probably in our world, that do cook that way, that just want suggestions or ideas to improve upon what they're doing. So that's very helpful. Mm-hmm. Now, what about the Vegetarian Flavor Bible that you... Did you see a trend happening with vegetables, or did you just change your diet?
You're looking at me, but I'm looking at Karen right now, because this was her inspiration completely.
Well, you know, all of the above. The Vegetarian Flavor Bible, in some ways, is the second edition of the Flavor Bible. I'll just come out and say that, because if you were reading the media last year, you would have heard that Joel Robuchon said that the cuisine of the next 10 years will be vegetarian. If you open the New York Times today and read the article on the evolution of Noma, you'll see they're moving to a point of offering a vegetarian menu at the number one restaurant in the world for 50% of the year during spring and summer. And I think that you're seeing top chef after top chef after top chef really evolving in that direction, where they're cutting back on the meat. They're really playing up the vegetables, which the vegetables, the herbs and spices are really the heart and soul, the flavor profile of any dish. So
Jose Andres too.
Sure.
Because he's doing the beef steak.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. There is that movement that's been happening.
Absolutely. And all the chefs offering vegetarian and even vegan tasting menus. We've had them at Per Se. We've had them at the Inn at Little Washington in Virginia. We've had them at 11 Madison mm-hmm. Park. We've had them at Danielle.
Picholine.
Picholine, absolutely.
And actually, sometimes we'll do one veg, one vegan. Nothing's repeated. It's not like one little tweak. It's like, I mean, two very different menus being presented. And they don't blink. It's like, oh, actually, we went to our... To take it the full circle, we went to the Mexican restaurant in our neighborhood, and we would say, oh, we haven't been in a long time because we didn't think he did vegetarian food. He goes, oh, we have a whole vegetarian menu. So you're seeing it from, like, the local guy in New York City all the way up to dual pairing menus at the very top restaurants in the country. It's a pretty amazing trend.
So I think as you see the very best chefs in the world really focus on vegetarianism, it's interesting. I think in the 1960s you saw it much more from an ethical standpoint or from an environmental standpoint, when you realize what it takes to produce a pound of beef, what you could do use with those same inputs to produce an equivalent amount of grain is very different. So from an environmental standpoint, that really drove a lot of people to vegetarianism in the sort of the 60s and 70s, as did other considerations. Now, I think what's interesting and different is that you're seeing people coming to vegetarianism or just, you know, vegetable-centric cuisine through a love of vegetables, through a love of flavor. And I think that is very different than something that we've ever seen before. And so I think whatever reason you come to it, we don't really care. We see that the movement is going in that direction. If you look at the trends of meat consumption in the United States, it's fallen every year since 2007. And that is a trend that's predicted to continue into the foreseeable future. So for a whole host of reasons. And, you know, I think when you bring health into the equation, and that was the publication of the China study, which was the most far-reaching nutritional study of our time, well over a million copy bestseller, that pointed to the fact that the huge correlation between overconsumption of meat and what they call the diseases of affluence, you know, the cancer, the heart disease, and so forth. We as Americans are killing ourselves. We're getting to a point where kids today have lower shorter life expectancies than their parents, and that's a crime. And so I think we need to get to a point where we're smart about what we eat. I don't think that the world is ever going to become 100% vegetarian, but I think we need to move for a whole host of reasons toward the direction of continuing to decrease per capita meat consumption in the United States. We have been traditionally one of the highest consumers of meat in the world. India, on the other hand, is one of the lowest. I think 40% of their population on average tends to be vegetarian. That's about 5% in the United States plus the 2% that's vegan. But when you add to that the 47% of Americans that are actively looking to reduce their meat consumption for health reasons or other reasons, that's 54% of Americans today that are looking to reduce or eliminate meat from their diet. That's a huge sea change in cuisine. And so when those customers are going into fine dining restaurants, other right. restaurants, they're making those requests. The chefs are responding in turn. Yeah. So it's like, are you going to lead the pack or are you going to respond? Either way, you're going to want the vegetarian flavor Bible.
That's what I'm saying. Everyone go buy this book. Okay. Wow. That was a lot of information. It was excellent. I'm thinking you're so knowledgeable doing all this research. Okay, we need to take another break. So we are, and we're going to come back and do my speed round and talk some industry news. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie? Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie? Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie just for me, girl? Please don't give none away. Let it get sweeter by the day. Oh, won't you save it, baby? Won't you save it? Oh, won't you save it all for me?
If I had a magic wand, tomorrow everyone in the world would have enough food to eat that was culturally appropriate and delicious. The planet would be thriving because all the food would have been grown and produced in a way that sustains us, both our bodies and our world. But man, I do not have a magic wand. What I do have is you and this radio station. The Heritage Radio Network. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help lead the way to a future that's more delicious, that's more fun, where we're healthier, where the planet's healthier, and we want you to be a part of that. We can't do it without you. As a nonprofit radio station, we depend on the support of our listeners. So take a minute out of your day, visit the website, and click the big beating donate tab. Throw us a few bucks. Every bit helps. We're counting on you.
Okay, we're back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guests are Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg. It's time for my speed round game. So what this is I name two things or more, and you pick your preference.
Okay.
Oh,
seatbelts
well,
on.
We should probably tell you in advance that we tend to be both and people. We don't like either or. We're
well,
all encompassing.
Okay.
It's the game. There are no rules, but we'll see how you do.
Okay. We're open.
All right. Eat in or eat out?
Both and. Gosh. How could you choose?
Breakfast and lunch in. Breakfast is a very personal thing.
Okay.
Dinner out, man.
Okay.
What's going on? What's so-and-so cooking tonight? Who's got a cool special?
Excellent. Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
All of the above. You know we wrote What to Drink with What You Eat. And it's not just a food and wine pairing book. It's a food plus wine plus beer plus cocktails plus sake plus mocktails plus water, coffee, tea pairing book. Because I couldn't give any of those up. It depends. With the right food, you want the right beverage. And why should you limit yourself?
I hear you.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I mean, okay. Don't even get me started on water. I go, you know, and before that we did the book, like water, who thinks about water? We think about water now.
You know, I added in mocktail because a few of my guests, you know, were picking mocktail, and now I might have to add in water. But then it would be too much. I could add in milk. I mean,
it could
go crazy. So I'll stick with my four. Okay. Tasting menu or a la carte?
Depends on the restaurant and the occasion, but typically I'm a tasting menu girl because what I've found is when I go into a restaurant, I like having a conversation with the chef through their food. And so I like going in, if they offer a tasting menu, seeing what that is, seeing what they send, seeing the way a chef thinks about the order of a menu, the way that you might compose a poem. You can, you know, a really astute chef who,
right,
you know, really puts forward a point of view through the menu design. I like hearing what they have to say, especially if I haven't met the chef yet, because I feel like I get to know them a lot through their tasting menus. So I typically like, especially if I'm eating someplace for the first time, like to do tasting menu.
I would agree. And then the other thing is if they are doing pairings, again, we're both and people, we like to split a wine pairing or a beverage pairing, because sometimes you will get a cocktail, a mocktail, a glass of wine. We had a tasting menu one time with Norman Van Aken, and he ended up serving a red wine before a white wine, which back in that day was like crazy. Yes. Well, it turned out to be a very light Beaujolais to go with a little bit of risotto and truffle, and the next course was heavier, and he poured a white Burgundy. It's like perfect.
Right.
So I think that's there's a lot of fun. We've had a lot of cool beer pairings that way, too, that I would normally not go for.
Okay. Let's keep going. Mm-hmm. How about small plates or large plates?
Depends on the dish and the place. I love them both.
Okay.
Yeah, if I'm out for tapas, small plates. If I'm out of, you know, for pizza, I want a big plate. I want my own pie.
Communal table or chef's counter? Should I just end the game?
No. Yeah, I guess we're not the ones putting the speed in the speed round, are we?
Some people are speed, some people aren't, and it's fine.
And actually, for me, I would say neither, because I really like being just out to dinner with Karen, just the two of us, where we can really talk. I mean, we never turn it off. It's like anything we get at the table, we're going to talk about.
Right.
And I love just being, she's my favorite guest, so I just want to hang out with her and talk about
food. Thank
you,
sweetheart.
So
he
so,
must be inspired because it was just our 25th wedding anniversary.
So I want to
anniversary.
I want to do this.
It's a big one.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I would go with either depending on the...
There are no rules.
Yeah. Okay. If I'm at mini bar, I'm going to sit at the chef's counter. If I'm at...
Okay.
You know... Communal table. Where do we eat at the communal table?
I don't know. I don't give dead air, but I don't know.
No.
But it did recently, and it was a blast. We ended up chatting with the people next to us, and it was fun.
Actually, at DB Bistro Moderne, we met the sweetest young women in the industry. We never would have met them before, and we had a great conversation.
House of fire.
You know, they have their moments.
Okay. Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Good topical question.
Well, thank you.
You know what? I think whatever makes the server inspired to give the best service. So if this is a trend that is inspiring better service, I'm all for all-inclusive. Whatever offers the best incentive to the servers.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think it is situational, but it's sort of funny. Like, we went to Superiority Burger recently. Well, not recently. We've been there
one of my solo dining experiences at Superiority Burger.
Crazy for Superiority Burger, but like... I'm looking for the tip jar. It was so good. And they're like, no, we're okay. You know? And then I thought, I go to Shake Shack. And there's no tip jar. It's like everyone's just taken care of and paid well. And they're all happy and engaged. And the service is good and fast. And so, you know, I think it is situational. But there is times where when you go out to a nice meal, and here's what's funny. People get all uptight about this. I'll try to beat this fast. But, like, if you go out with a party of six, they include the tip. 20% service charge is right there. So why is everyone so uptight about the tip? It's like, it's been around for a long time.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, at Dirt Candy, it seems to work really well, and they seem to love it. Yeah. So, bravo.
Great service.
Amanda.
I've been asking the tipping or all-inclusive charge question since a year and a half ago, and it's... The answers are starting to change. For the first, I think, 40 episodes, everyone said tipping. But it is. It's very fascinating, either or. Okay, so we're running...
Okay, we'll be fast.
We're running low on time. So let's go quick on the last ones. We got meat or vegetables.
Oh.
Veggies.
We've been eating vegetarian.
Here you go with that
years.
One.
Okay.
Hard copy, paperback, or ebook.
Hard copy or paperback?
Yeah, with a highlighter.
And of course, we were early adapters to Kindle. We read a lot on our iPad, but I love paper. I'm an author. What can I say?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
I would skip both and jump over to Superiority Burger for a $4 sorbet.
I have to go back and get that because I didn't have
it.
Oh,
you're kidding.
No,
we went back the second night. The night after we were there for the first time, we went back again just for dessert, just for the sorbet and the gelato. It's amazing. It's the best $4 you can spend in New York City today. There, I said it. there you go, Brooks. That one's for
fabulous.
You.
Last one, Manhattan or Brooklyn?
I'm going to go with both on that one. I would never want to give up Pauly G's.
I love Pauly G.
But if it's an anniversary or a birthday and there's a zero or a five, you know, I kind of want to go to Danielle and just let the dice roll.
When I first moved to New York City, I moved to Brooklyn. That was where I fell in love with Andrew. But now we live in Manhattan and 25 years later, and we like that too. So I say both and again.
Okay. Done. We're behind on time. So for industry news, one of the articles I had was, you mentioned it already, in the New York Times, Renee Renzeppi is planning to close NoMa and reopen it as an urban farm. It was in by Jeff Gordonaire. So people should check that out because...
Absolutely. It's a wonderful article. Actually, there's a lot there to kind of unpack. But I love that Jeff on Twitter, I think just today said, or the other day, said that was his most... eye-opening insight from doing that story was the fact that it was turning vegetarian for 50% of the year. So really interesting.
Have
trend.
You been there? Because I haven't.
We haven't.
And now the question is, like, I was thinking, I want to rush and go before he changes it. But rush and go. I mean, he's closing it at the end of 2016. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I do want to go at some point, and I don't think it matters when. I just want to see what they're doing out there. Mm-hmm. So... the other news we just to announce that so this coming Monday is Cher's second helping of life benefit.
Absolutely.
You're going to be there, Karen. I'm going to be there.
Excellent. It's the place to be. All the cool kids are there on Monday night.
It's a great event. It's on Pier 60. I'm going to be helping Barbara Sibley at La Palapa out. So.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yes, I've worked with Barbara before in that event, and that's where I first met her. That's why it's so great to go and do it. And now, and I'm going to blank on her name. Oh, I'm so sorry, Lauren, the chef de cuisine of Maria. I'm paired with, and I'll be helping her serve her, I believe it's a chilled tomato soup. Get it while you can.
Okay, I will be there.
And it's a wonderful cause. It raises money to help survivors of breast and ovarian cancer. It's a phenomenal event.
It really is. And the other news we had was, Karen, you're going to be at the 92nd Street Y on November 9th interviewing Mader Jaffrey.
Yes, so absolutely. She's got a great vegetarian India book coming out, and really looking forward to that. It's going to be a great night.
Terrific. Okay, we're going to take one more break. I'm going to do my solo dining experience. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience this week, which is at a new pop-up restaurant called Eureka. Here's the rundown. Location, 639 Washington Avenue at Creative Edge Studio in Manhattan's West Village. The concept, an ongoing three-day-a-week chef's counter and tasting menu. The chef, 16-year-old Flynn McGarry. Why did I go? Because this young chef has received much praise and attention for his cooking and his age, and I really wanted to try his food. My experience. I arrived for a 6 p.m. seating along with 10 other diners. Champagne was offered, but I passed and opted for the sparkling water. I was the only solo diner and seated between two really nice couples who I enjoyed conversation with during our 14-course tasting menu. We sat around a horseshoe arrangement with the open kitchen in the middle. Flynn worked quietly center stage, preparing the entire meal. Aside from his managing partner, Matthew Maiko, who was the maitre d' and server for the evening, there were no helpers. It was a very impressive and well-executed evening. What did I get? Well, the dinner began with a few small bites, including foie gras cured with peanut and sour cherry. Main courses included hamachi, summer squash, followed by winter squash, and dry-aged ribeye. And one of the two desserts was sesame ganache. My take. Every course was nicely presented in beautiful dishes, and it was all really good. My favorite courses were the sea urchin with carrots and coffee, and it was a very interesting combination that worked, and the winter squash and pine semifreddo with grapefruit as the other dessert. The scene. Foodies. Perfect for anyone who appreciates an original tasting menu. Interesting tidbits. At the age of 10, Flynn decided he wanted to be a cook. Since age 13, he's had a fine dining supper club, which turned into a monthly Eureka pop-up restaurant in L.A. He gained notoriety being featured in the New Yorker, Talk of the Town, and then on the cover of the New York Times Magazine Food and Wine issue. He's staged or worked at 11 Madison Park, Alinea, Alma, and more. Personal fun fact. At the age of 16, I was a hostess at a local Miami restaurant called Carlos and Pepe's. That was my first restaurant job, and my parents thought I was ambitious. The cost, $160, including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Yes. I see very good things for this young chef. All the best to you, Flynn. The website is eurekanyc.com. Okay, it's time for the final question. So are you good? Well, first, are you guys planning to go to this dinner, Eureka?
I don't know, 16?
And he's 16.
Wow.
Yeah.
And when he turns 70, he's going to raise the price to $170?
I don't know. It's gotten, people have been talking about that, but I'm glad I went. I thought he, you know, yeah. I was curious, and I thought he did a great job.
That's cool.
So, okay, the final question. So next week, my guest is Brett Trossi. He's director of operations at the Dynex Group.
Oh, we love Brett.
You know Brett.
Yes.
Cool.
Of course, he's great.
So what would you like to ask him?
What would we like to ask Brett?
Yeah, whatever you want.
Brett, how the heck are you? We haven't seen him in ages. Actually, we had the wonderful time with our mutual friend, Steve Bechta, who's one of the top restaurateurs in Ottawa. And I think Steve and his wife, Maureen, were there, and mm-hmm. we were all at Brett's place. So actually, wasn't Gail Simmons there that night with
yes.
her squeeze? And it was way too many years ago. So, Brett, how the heck are you?
Okay.
Karen and Andrew want to know.
Done. Terrific. Well, that's the show.
Oh, well, this was so much fun, Sherry. Thank you so much for having us on.
I know. It flies by. Thank you. I'm in awe of your careers, all of your books, all of just your collaboration together and everything you do. So congratulations.
And I'm glad you're so ambitious at 16, Dean.
Yeah, next time we talk, we'll compare jobs at 16.
Yeah.
No, I was actually a waitress. I waited on the guy with the... Guinness Book of World Records record for dining out. He'd eaten at the most restaurants
oh,
in
wow.
the world. Yeah, fascinating. And right. I thought that was the peak of my culinary career.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, mine too. No. Okay, so I've been speaking with Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg. They are award-winning journalists. You can find them on their website, karenandandrew.com. Their Twitter is at @KarenAndAndrew, and their Instagram is at @TheFlavorBible. Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay. Terrific. You can follow me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR at All Industry. My Facebook book page is All in the Industry, and my website's BayerPublicRelations.com. As a reminder, all of our shows are archived on heritageradionetwork.org. We are also on Stitcher and iTunes. Our new Heritage Radio website is launching next week. Super exciting. I hope you'll check it out. It's going to be fabulous. Thanks to Karen and Andrew and to Jack and Liz over there in the studio who do the engineering for this show. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'll be back next Wednesday at 4 with another live show. Thanks for being part of All in the Industry. Bye.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.